22. August 4th, continued. By 4 o'clock, I had caught and cleaned 3 middle-sized fish. From the pond, as I sat, I could look down on the field of wheat, a darker green acre in the pasture that stretched toward the gap. We were not trying for a real wheat crop, but only a harvest of seeds, and it would surely produce that at least. I put the fish on a string and walked to the house. I placed his share, 1 1/2 fish, on the back porch, hoping he was watching so he would know to pick them up. The cow was waiting to be milked and fed, but gave only 1/2 a can of milk, less each day, but better than none, which was what it would be soon. I turned her back out to pasture, closed the barn door, put the top on my can, and walked back to the store, through for the day. I had reached it, and was debating which way to go, when I heard the tractor engine faint in the distance. It was earlier than he had used it the other times, and I wondered why. It sputtered slowly for a couple of minutes, and then suddenly smoothed out and was running fast. It got louder very quickly. He was on the blacktop and was coming my way at top speed. I debated no longer, but made a dash up the hill to the right of the pond to reach the woods behind it before he turned the bend. I slopped a bit of my milk, but I made it. Once in the woods, I circled to the left as I ran to reach a spot from which I could watch. I did not worry about crashing noisily through the brush. The tractor engine was getting louder all the time. I found a vantage point behind a bush, set down my milk, crouched, and waited. The tractor had come out of the trees and ran in plain view down the blacktop, covering the last 1/2 mile to the store. Mr. Loomis sat astride, steering with his left hand. In his right, to my amazement and horror, he held his rifle. He looked like an Indian on horseback in an old Western movie, attacking a wagon train. I stared, at first not comprehending at all. About 100 feet from the store, he turned the tractor halfway around and stopped it, leaving the engine idling. He climbed down on the far side, keeping it between him and the building. He stood there, watching for a minute or two, then cut the engine and put the key in his pocket. Holding the gun in both hands, he moved toward the store. His eyes were on the windows and the door. I remembered how he had acted once before when he fired 2 shots into the house. He suffered a relapse, I thought. He is back in his delirium. But no, it was quite clearly different. That time he had been dreaming. There was nothing dreamlike in the way he moved forward now, alert as a cat, to the door. He paused, listened, and backed away. He looked to the right, to the left, behind him. Then, moving more quickly, he circled the building, disappearing from my view, reappearing, staring at every window, upstairs and down. Back at the door, he opened it with the greatest caution, then pushed it wide and stepped inside. I stayed motionless behind my bush, watched and wondered, why was he storming this door? Storm was the word I thought of, because that was really how it looked, like a surprise attack. Why the gun? Did he intend to shoot something? To shoot me? Why else does one carry a gun? For 10 minutes or so, all was quiet. I stared at the building and the tractor. A movement caught my eye. A curtain pushed aside in an upstairs window, and his face looking out, pale in the dark frame like a ghost in a haunted house. And I knew part of the answer. He was not in the store proper at all. He had gone up to the Klein's living quarters on the 2nd floor. He was, of course, looking for me. I had deceived him too well. Each night when I left the house, I had walked toward the store. In the morning, when he had watched, I had appeared suddenly beside the store. That same morning I had gone to get his water from the pond, in the same general direction as the store, and reappeared carrying things of mine, milk can and knife. So he had, quite sensibly, decided that I was living in the store. He had, I supposed, the first time he went into it, discovered there were living quarters upstairs. Perhaps he had even gone up and looked. But, in fact, I had only been in the Klein's apartment 1 time since they drove away that day with my parents. It was on a rainy Sunday, after I had been to the church. Since it was Sunday, I did not want to work. It was too rainy to fish or to take a walk, as I sometimes did. And by then the radio stations had all gone off, so I had decided to read, and, as always, was wishing I had some new books. It occurred to me the Kleins might have had some. Their apartment was shadowy. too heavily curtained for a gray day. It was entirely clean, as Mrs. Klein, a small and tidy woman, would have left it, but it had a stale smell from being shut up. I felt quite uneasy. Though I had been there once or twice before, it was a private place, and everything in it belonged to two dead people. I knew as soon as I entered I was not likely to find any books, and there were none, not even magazines, with two exceptions, a dress pattern book near Mrs. Klein's sewing machine, and some account and inventory books in a room Mr. Klein used for an office. I even looked in their bedroom, feeling guiltier than ever, but there was only the usual furniture and some pictures on the walls. Also, the only thing in the whole apartment that was out of place. It was a photograph of a young man, smiling, dressed in a dark suit and necktie in a stand-up frame. It looked quite old. It lay on the bed face up. I wondered who he could be. Either Mr. or Mrs. Klein had obviously looked at it one more time before leaving. A son? I could not recall anything about their having a son. It might have looked a little like Mrs. Klein when she was younger, so perhaps it was a brother. I never found out, of course. I left it lying on the bed. The point was, however, that Mr. Loomis was sure to know at a glance that I was not living there. That was why he had looked out the window. If I was not there, he was thinking, I must be somewhere in the vicinity. He came out the front door again, looked around, and went back in. When he reappeared about 30 seconds later from behind the store, he had walked straight through it and gone out the back door, which I could not see from my vantage point. He had left the gun inside. He walked a few yards away, turned, and appeared to be studying the building, tapping his chin with his hand. Then he disappeared again. I could guess he had gone in through the back door, and for 15 minutes or so I could not see him. I thought of the gun again. It was frightening to see, but perhaps not so frightening as it had seemed at first. I was beginning to get used to the way his mind worked, the way he thought about things. There was a pattern that kept repeating. In the case of the gun, it meant, or I thought it might mean, not that he was planning to shoot me, but that he thought I might shoot him. I still think that might be correct. He may have reasoned that if I was encamped in the store and saw him coming, I might be frightened and might try to drive him away. But what made him think I had a gun at all? My guns had been at the cave all of the time since his arrival, and I was quite sure I had never mentioned them. He had had plenty of time for thinking, I realized, and during the past 2 weeks he must have recalled his first day here, the day he came over the hill in his safe suit, pulling his wagon, and went to the house. He had seen, thanks to my carefulness, that it was empty, and had not recently been lived in. Thinking back on that, he would realize that I had had, even then, another place to live. He would know, too, that in a country household where people hunt, there are always guns, so he would assume that if I had moved out of the house, I would have taken them with me. All this he would have thought of, sitting by himself in the house day after day, and of something else as well. He would have decided that if I had a place reasonably comfortable and well set up, not just living in the woods, I was not so likely to give up after a few days and move back to the house, to stop the stupidity, as he called it, unless he did something to force me to do it. The sun was getting ready to set when I saw him again. He came around from behind the building. He must have gone out the back door again, and he carried something in his hand. In the waning light, without the binoculars, I could not see what it was, only that it was small, and it was not the gun. He walked to the front door and stood before it. Because he was under the porch roof, in the shadow, it was hard to see just what he was doing. But he seemed to be examining the door itself, and even reached out and touched the frame with his hand. He put down whatever it was he was holding, went inside, and came out again almost immediately, carrying something else. For the next 15 minutes he stood there, working busily at what I could not see but only guess. At the end of that time he made one more brief trip into the store and emerged with the gun. He started the tractor and drove off toward the house. When I heard the motor fade in the distance and finally sputter and die, I stood up and came out from behind my bush, not forgetting my milk and fish. It was getting dark. I considered going on to the cave. But I was too curious. I wanted to see if what I guessed and feared was right. I walked down to the store to look, and it was. He had put padlocks on both front and back doors, and both were locked. That night, back at my fireplace, I changed my plans and cooked the fish, which would not keep, and wrapped the chicken, which would keep, in a piece of paper and put it in a cool place in the cave. I was thinking about the padlocks without any keys and the tractor without any key. At first, I thought that, to go into the store and to use the tractor, I would have to ask permission each time. But then I had a worse thought. He was not going to give me any of the keys at all, to anything.